I'm Bob, an alcoholic. Before we go on to fear and sex, or fear of sex, I don't know what the... I want to tell you a little story about the resentment section of the fourth step. There's a power in this shift in perception that is remarkable. Maybe 15 years ago, I was sponsoring a guy, and he had just finished his fourth step, and he got together with me, and we were doing his fifth step, and we got about a third of the way through his resentment list, and buried in the middle was the worst resentment he had, and it was towards his father. And his father was a horrid, violent alcoholic, and his dad, throughout the kid's whole childhood, would get drunk and beat this poor kid within an inch of his life. And as a child, he ended up in the emergency room on several occasions with broken bones and contusions. And he was so ashamed of what was going on at home, he would make up stories about he fell off his bike or he fell out of a tree. And there wasn't the diligence about child abuse that is, happens today. And nobody knew. He had said it a couple occasions. His dad was actually forced into abstinence briefly because his dad would get in so much trouble that, you know, he'd get sober briefly. But he said, but it was even worse when his dad was sober because he'd be so irritable, and so his abstinence would make him insane, even worse. And he'd yell and he'd scream and get to your room and shut up and you're stupid. And this kid had a childhood of horror and abuse. He'd spent 8 years in therapy trying to get free of it. He beat pillows. He did the Gestalt chair. He did all that stuff trying to get free of this resentment towards his father. It affected his relationships. It affected his ability to work and be a team player. He had this thing with authority. He had a tough time. So he had to, consequently, he had a couple little businesses that that sometimes he'd do well, sometimes he wouldn't. He was better. He seemed better off working for himself rather than trying to work for somebody else. And this really owned him. And here it is. Here it is, right in the middle of his fifth step. We start talking about it. And he's dumps it all out. And when he's done, I told him, I read him a paragraph out of, in step 10, in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, there's a paragraph in there where Bill really expands on the principle that we're supposed to adopt here in this was our course. And he expands it out in step 10 because this is something we're going to do the rest of our life. And he says it beautifully in step 10. And this is not a direct quote, but it's something along the lines, as we approach true tolerance and see what real love actually means, it becomes more and more pointless to get angry or we start to see how other people like ourselves are frequently wrong as well as emotionally ill. And it gets pointless to become angry at people who like us are suffering from the pains of growing up. And then I went back to the book and I read the paragraph on this was our course. And I said to him, I said, you have to realize how you were perhaps how you were like your dad, sick too. And when he heard me imply like your dad, he flipped out. And he was really aggravated that I would imply that he was like his father, who he hated. And he went on this rant and just cussing, and I like my goddamn, all this venom's coming out of him. And if you've ever been around somebody that just all this venom, this anger's coming out of him, it's a very frightening thing. And I'm just sitting there and I'm just kind of backing away because the guy's exploding. And I don't know what to say to him. And he runs out of gas and he's sitting there, he's just kind of glaring. And all I can think of is this, well, he's evidently not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle, I guess. I don't know. I ain't got nothing here for you. And what happened next, I believe, was the grace of God. When I listen to a fifth step, before I listen to one, I ask the guy that's going to take it to get quiet and invite God in to what we're about to do. And then as he's doing that, I do a similar thing. I ask God to use me. And I found myself, I didn't know what to say, so I just like motioned him on. He started reading this next resentment. And he gets about halfway through this next resentment, and I stopped him because now something's happening inside of me. And I said to him, I want to go back to another resentment. And at first he thought I wanted him to talk more about his dad, and he got a little on the muscle with me. And I said, no, not about your dad. I want to go back to that resentment in the beginning, that woman that you lived with for all those years. And that she eventually threw you out and rejected you. And he said, yeah, what about it? I said, there were kids there, weren't there? He said, yeah, what of it? I said to him, listen, I'm just wondering. If in all those years you were in that relationship and you were with those kids, if there ever was a moment when you were drunk or stoned on drugs or hungover where you might have ever done anything to hurt those kids. And it looked like the blood ran out of his face. And he hung his head down, and I don't know what's going on with this guy. And he lifts his head up, and I just remember there's just on one side, there was a tear coming down his cheek. And I remember the voice. There was a lot of pain in this voice, as if it came from some tortured abyss within him. And he said, I'm just like my goddamn father. And I said to him, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He said, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, how do you think your dad was? Do you think he might have been like that? And you know, he said, I don't know. I haven't talked to my dad. I've hated him for so long. I have nothing to do with him. But he's a bad alcoholic. And I don't know that he's ever been able to get sober. He said, my sister told me that she's the only one that goes and sees him anymore. Nobody else in the family has anything to do with him. And he lives in a little trailer all by himself out in the middle of the California desert. And his sister had told him that his dad had been forced to stop drinking because of liver and pancreas problems. And he'd try to drink, and he'd just be racked with pain. His body would not process alcohol anymore. And so he lived all alone in this trailer, and his sister said that he was the most negative, lonely, depressed person she'd ever known. And she would make herself go over there, and it would be torturous just to be around him. But he was all alone. And I said to him at one point, do you think you could be like that? And at one point he said to me, maybe without Alcoholics Anonymous, my father is a vision of my future. And we started doing the last part of this where it says, putting out of your mind the wrongs his dad had did, disregarding his father entirely. What kind of a son were you? And he said, if my dad really was sick like I think he is, I never cared about that. All I cared about is me. He said, I was a terrible son. I borrowed thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars over the years off my father and never paid him back a dime because he's an asshole, and justified every bit of it. I gossiped and slandered about him to the point where he said he turned most of the family against his father. But that wasn't a hard turn because his father irritated everybody. Until his dad was pretty much all alone except for the one sister who kept going over there. And we talked about this amends process because what we're really doing is it's odd. They don't tell you this in the beginning, but everybody on your resentment list ends up on your eighth step list. Isn't that horrid? Oh, my God. And we got to the amends part where he had to disregard his father entirely and he had to go face his dad. And he called me up. He didn't have a cell phone. I don't think many, this was, it might have been even before cell phones. There weren't many cell phones in those days. He called me up from a pay phone outside this trailer park. And he told me he was scared. And we talked a little bit. And I said, you know, you got to, you're going in there to clear up your side of the street. You're going in there to forgive your dad. You're going in there to be the son that you've never been able to be, regardless of how sick your father is. And he went and I said, call me when you're done. And he called me up later and I said, what happened? He said, well, you know, I went to the door of the trailer. I was scared to death. I felt like there was going to be a monster on the other side of that door. And I knocked on the door and it wasn't a monster that opened up the door. It was this little old shriveled up old man. And he said, I looked at my dad and he was pathetic. He was lonely and depressed and weak and shaky. And he said, at one point I looked in my father's eyes and I saw myself. And he made the amends to his father and he opened a door. And when he made the amends for how he reacted and what he did to his father, it was like a dam broke. And his father was able to ask him to forgive him. You see, alone, his dad didn't have what it took to make the amends. He didn't have the tools. But once he opened the door and cleared up his side of the street, his father fell right in line. And he spent all that money he owed his dad, he used to take care of his father until his father died. And he started spending a lot of time with his dad. And they actually became very close. And he said one time at a... We had him speak at be the 10-minute speaker at this little meeting, and he said that the greatest thing Alcoholics Anonymous had ever given him, next to his sobriety, is he got his daddy back. And he'd been in therapy 8 years, trying to get that, and he couldn't get free of it. Because there was too much of him blocking the grace of God that had to come in so he could forgive his father. Because he had to first understand his father, and to understand his father, he had to understand himself. See, what he saw dead on was he saw his dad's pain. He saw the insanity. He told me about his dad's childhood and how his dad had been so brutally abused as a kid. Hurt people hurt people. We don't mean to. It's almost like sometimes they can't help it. This is a powerful thing. This is where we get restored. And that brings us to the next section of the inventory on fear. You know, fear's a funny thing. The book says that it's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. And that is so true. It's so true to the point where by the time I'm over four years sober and I'm doing my first by-the-book inventory, the resentment list was easy. And I'll tell you something, I'll tell you a funny thing. Most of the resentments by the time I'm 4 years sober are people in AA. Well, it's where they have all the stupid people grouped, right? You know what I mean? I mean, but I think I'd resented all my, I found something wrong with about everybody I knew in AA at some time or another, you know? And I got to the fear list. I'd finished the resentment list, and I got to the fear list. I'm sitting at the kitchen table in my apartment with this legal pad, and I wrote fear across the top of the page, and I'm sitting there, and I'm drawing a blank. I can't think of anything I'm afraid of. And I knew that when I first got sober, I was facing the 2 years in prison. That haunted me. I was afraid of being home. But it seemed to me that all the things that I was afraid of, I'm no longer afraid of. And I felt as if maybe I don't have any fears. And so I went to this intergroup meeting, and there was a guy speaking from out of town, and him and my sponsor and I and a bunch of people went out to a restaurant after the meeting. And I'm talking to these guys, and I said to this old timer, I said, you know, I'm writing a fear inventory, and I discovered I don't have any fears. And he said, really? I said, yeah, I can't think of anything I'm afraid of. Huh. He said, can I ask you some questions? I well said, sure. He said, are you afraid of large, angry, barking dogs? Well, I mean, everybody is. We're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. Well, yeah. So are you afraid of rattlesnakes? Well, everybody, we're talking about, yeah. Black widow spider, yeah. You afraid of dying old and alone? Yeah. Are you afraid of what people think of you? All the time. Are you afraid of, he said, are you afraid of cancer? My first 4 years of sobriety, I must have had cancer 50 times. I mean, I had eloquent death rehearsed in my mind, deathbed speeches. I mean, that I never got to use. One time I woke up in the morning and I knew I had some kind of leukemia or bone cancer. So I could, something's wrong with my leg, and I could feel it in there. And I went down to the hospital, and $175 later, 2 hours later, I'm late for work to find out that I slept on my leg funny. You know, I'm in the hospital rehearsing the speech. I'm picturing, they'll probably ask me to talk at the convention before I die, and I'll tell them all. You know, so when he says, you're afraid of cancer, I thought, oh my, yeah. He said, are you afraid of rejection? Yeah. Are you afraid of being sick, can't take care of yourself? Are you afraid of that nobody will ever love you? Are you afraid that maybe God doesn't really care about you the way he seems to care about these people in AA? Are you afraid of stuff out of your past catching up with you? Are you afraid you'll never really make all these things right? All this money you owe, you'll never make all your amends. Are you afraid of homosexuality? And I'd spent time in jail where I was always worried about that, you know. And he went on and on and on. And he finally said, so, is there anything you're not afraid of? And I was like, how do you do that? How did he do that to me? It's like some kind of jujitsu. I mean, it's like they just turn her. I mean, if you're new and you don't want to change and all you want is relief, stay away from the old timers. They just use that spiritual jujitsu stuff on you. Next thing you know, you're wrong. How does that happen? How come I'm always the guy that's wrong? Well, that's the nature of the beast. And I started making my resentment list. In the book, has some very specific things to say about it. It talks about fears. It says that fear, and this is brilliant. Wilson was brilliant. He says fear sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought me misfortune I felt I didn't deserve, but did not I myself start the ball rolling? Well, what does that mean? Well, psychiatrists refer to this as self-fulfilling prophecies. That I get a fear, and the fear drives me to change my, unconsciously, to change my position or angle of approach to life until I make the fear come true. I give you a couple examples. One was a first relationship I ever got in sobriety. I got into this relationship, and I'm not sober very long. I don't have very much self-esteem, and I got a lot of fear. What's the fear? The fear is she's going to dump me. I want to be hooked up with someone. I don't want to be dumped. So what happens? Well, the fear drives me. I don't know that it's driving me. It's shifting me, and it's controlling my actions. Fear is the muscle of the ego. You want to get me to act selfishly and crazy and nuts? Scare me. And next thing I know, I'm driving by her apartment at 3 o'clock in the morning, just making sure no guys' cars are there. You know, I'd watch people hug her at a meeting, and I'd go up to her, hey, don't be hugging my girlfriend. People started thinking I was nuts. I went through her, she left the room one time, I went through her purse looking to see if there's any guys' cards in there, a phone number. I mean, It drove me to be smothering and controlling and possessive. And here's the sad part. I don't even know I'm doing that. My sponsor tried to tell me. He says, you're going to run her off. I don't know what he's talking about. She said to me one time, she says, I don't like to go to meetings with you. I said, why not? She says, because every time I look up, you're looking at me. Well, yeah, I mean, and I didn't even know it. And what happened? I'm afraid she's going to leave me. What happened? The fear drove me to be so possessive and smothering, I literally drove her away out of my, like, drove her out of my life. And I made the fear come true. I remember the day she left. It was, she ended up going with some other guy. And I felt gut shot. And in the midst of this horrible feeling of desolation was this little voice, which is the voice of the enemy. And the little voice said to me, yeah, but you were right. I like being right. I'm dying here, but I'm right. I made it come true. Could my ego be that strong that it would destroy me to be right? That it would maneuver me around? I had a job one time before I got sober, and it was a tremendous opportunity for me. My father was very politically connected, and one of his best friends had just started this environmental engineering outfit, and it was back in the days when water pollution and air pollution, everything, all this stuff was like cutting edge stuff, and everybody's on the bandwagon for water and, you know, and air pollution. All the factories now are getting mandated to have their smokestacks tested and their water tested and everything. And this was a great opportunity. This guy gave me a job working at this company, and he was going to pay for my schooling and teach me the business so I could become an environmental engineer. A tremendous opportunity for me. But I went to work with a fear. And the fear is that the people that work there aren't going to accept me. That the people that are work there are probably saying things to each other like, well, you know that Bob. The only reason he's here is his dad's friends with the guy who owns the company. And I was afraid that they weren't going to accept me. So what happened? Well, the fear drove me to be defensive enough and on the muscle enough with those people. And like, what do you mean by that kind of thing? And that having walking around with that edge in me until one day they call me to the office and they say, Bob, you're a hard worker, but we're going to have to let you go because you just don't fit here. You're not a team player. And I made the fear come true. And I don't even see the sad thing about people that are asleep in their own lives is I don't even know I'm doing that. Because I can't see past myself. I can't see me the way you see me. Now, if you, like my sponsor said, you're going to drive her away. I can't see that. If I would have had a sponsor in those days, he would have said, you're going to lose that job if you keep acting like that at work. But I don't even know I'm doing it. It says, so these fear, they brought us misfortune we felt we did not deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more harm. Nothing has ever robbed me of abundance and love. An opportunity as fear has. How many opportunities come into our lives and your head says, that you wouldn't like, you can't do that again. And so my past is littered by unmet opportunities. By opportunities to love people and have friends. There's people in my life today that I'm very, very close to. My sponsor is one of them, where at one time I kept them like this. Why do I keep them like this? Why do I have a little judgment? Why do I keep them at arm's length? Because I'm afraid. I'm afraid if I let them in, they're not going to like me. So I reject them first because I don't want to risk it. Right? And he's one of the great people. He's one of the central figures in my life today. I kept him like that for a long time. There's things in my life I've come to just really love that I was afraid to try. I remember when I first got sober, there were people in AA that used to go on these ski trips. And, you know, they tried to talk, hey, why don't you come skiing with us? Oh, I don't like skiing. Well, have you ever been? No, but I know things. I should stop once in a while and ask my head, what's your source of information here? Well, what's really going on? I'm afraid. I'm afraid of the learning curve in skiing. I'll sign up for anything if I can start at the top. But I'm afraid of looking stupid. I'm afraid of falling down. And I didn't feel good enough about myself or trust God or life itself enough to take risks yet. So I discounted, never went skiing for 10 years. And when I was 10 years sober, I'd grown enough spiritually to take some risks. I started skiing. Within 2 years, I was an avid black diamond skier. I've skied all over the world. People asked me, they knew that I was used to playing bands and stuff. When I first got sober, they asked me, we're going to get a band together. Why don't you? I was afraid. I was afraid because I associated it in my mind with the old life. As a drunken, drugged up musician, I couldn't do it because I didn't trust God enough. You know, I didn't realize that my life is actually on a different basis. I can do these things now. A guy asked me if I wanted to go scuba diving with him and some guys that were going out to the lake. I wouldn't like that because I was afraid. And all these things have become important things to me in my life. And I was robbed of the opportunity of having their experience for years in sobriety because I'm scared. I'm afraid. When it says it should be classed with stealing, I don't think that's an exaggeration. There was a friend of mine who died of cancer named Rusty. He was sober a long time. He's one of the old timers in my first home group. And I used to sit with Rusty when he was dying. And he said to me one day, something I'll never forget. He said, you know, kid, he said, when you get into the home stretch and you look back over your life, it's not really the mistakes you made that are bad. It's the things that you were too afraid to try that you regret. The people you were afraid to love or let in. The opportunities that life had presented that you were too afraid to try. I never forgot that. I want to do it all. I trust God to the point today I'm almost dangerous. I mean, no, really, it's like I'm leaping. I'm jumping here. There's no abyss. I'm jumping. I know he'll catch me. I take a shot just about anything. I'm in. Scott, that's one of the things Scott and I say to I ran into him when we were scuba diving down Turks and Caicos. And I said, I'm going to Australia. You know what he says to me? He says what I would say. He says, I'm going too. I'm in. People call me up. Do you want to come over here and do this? Yep, I'm in. My daughter thinks I'm crazy sometimes. She says, where are you going? Such and such a city and such a state. She says, where are you staying? I don't know. You don't know? You have a place to stay there? Oh, I'm sure I do. But where, Dad? I don't know. How are you going to get there? I don't know. Somebody will pick me up. Who? I don't know. You're getting on an airplane. You're going to a city you've never been to before. You don't know where you're staying or who's picking you up, and you know no one there. Yeah, isn't that great? She thinks I'm nuts. But I've been doing this for years, and it always works out. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I do trust God today. I know that he'll take care of me. And that's what the book says. The answer is, we list our fears. We ask ourselves why we have them because we're going to uncover an unmade amends, unfinished business. What amends is just things that have to be mended. Amends are not a matter of right or wrong. That's the ego's territory. Amends is just mending separation. The spirit doesn't care about right or wrong. The spirit cares about unity. To become back one with. To mend. To mend the rip between me and this person, between me and life itself. So I asked myself why I had these fears. Sometimes I find out that I'm afraid. I have fears underneath fears underneath fears. So I'm talking to this guy, and he's telling me about he doesn't want to go to this one meeting. And I know that there's something kind of fear underneath that. I said, what are you afraid of at that meeting? Oh, I'm not afraid of anything. Okay, well, how come the idea of going to that meeting creates a little anxiousness in you, a little anxiety, apprehension? Well, it's not that. It's just, I don't like the people at that meeting. Huh. Anybody in particular? Well, you know, Joe goes there. I don't like Joe. I'm not my kind of guy. Oh, really? What don't you like about Joe? Oh, I just don't like him. He's an egotistical guy. I don't like him. I said, is there any chance that you're afraid of going to that meeting because you talk crap about Joe everywhere else in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're afraid somebody else has gotten it back to him, and now you're afraid to face him? And he looks at me like a deer in the headlights. And that's exactly what was going on. Why do you have the fears? Often you'll uncover some unfinished business. We run into people all the time. They're afraid of doing their taxes. Why? Because they cheat on their taxes. Years ago, we don't have this much anymore because you don't see too much of it, but 15 years ago, half the guys that got sober had a panic and a fear of having AIDS. Why? Well, because they stuck needles in their arm and they had unprotected sex almost regularly. Why do you have the fear? It's either something you are doing that you shouldn't have done or something you haven't done that you should have done. It's unfinished business. I had a guy come up to me one time. He's so funny. I was at this recovery house. And he says, can I talk to you? And he's sober 4 or 5 months, I guess. And he said, I'm doing a four-step and I'm stuck in the fear section. I have several fears and I don't know why I have them. And I said, well, let's talk about it. And he reaches in his pocket, he pulls out a cigarette, he lights it up, takes a hit off, and he says, well, I got this fear of cancer. And I don't know why I have it. You know, my parents didn't have cancer, and I've never traumatized by cancer as a child. I don't understand why I have a fear of cancer. And I'm looking at him like, he's looking for deep psychological reasons. I said to him, could it be because you smoke? And it was like, he looked at me like, oh, that's too simple. Why do we have these fears? Why do we have them? The book says, what's the answer? Well, we have to remember we're on a different basis. What basis? Not the basis of living your life on self-will, but the basis of the third step decision. I'm on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. I trust infinite God who can handle the load of my life rather than my finite selves. I don't know if anybody other than me has ever had the experience of being sober for a period of time and feeling like you're having a nervous breakdown. Because there's so much stuff to worry about. When I am the center of the universe and my life and everything around it is my responsibility, oh my God, there's stuff to worry about. There's a whole world out there full of people and they're all thinking stuff. I don't know what they're thinking, but you suspect it's about you, don't you? So you have to always be guessing. Sometimes you have to accuse people of things just to see. You know what I mean? Just to see. You feel like I remember one time I ended up in a psychiatrist's office. I was sober at my parents' house for several months, not drinking, just angst. And I had this like nervous breakdown. And he said, you got free-floating anxiety and a panic disorder. No, I had self-centered fear. I was trying to play God. I was the center of my life. I was trusting finite Bob rather than infinite God. It's almost, in the U.S., we have in the laundry rooms in our homes, we have this one electrical outlet that has 220 volts, and it's for the dryer. Now, everything else in the house is 110. But if you'd go into the kitchen and get an appliance that's designed for 110 and you plugged it into the 220, it's going to overload and burn out because it does not have the capacity to handle that load. And that's what I am like when I am trying to handle my life. I don't have the capacity. I will either angst up and just a terrible anxiety and then implode into depression. I don't have the capacity to handle the load. That's why I need God. There's a thing that bleeds into AA every once in a while out of treatment centers and out of psychology that might be legitimate for non-alcoholics, but I don't think it's right for us. And it's a sentiment that these feelings of inadequacy, these feelings that you're not enough, that something we should strive to get over, this is as if we need to become complete and whole. I think that's wrong. I think the best and the most precious thing I have within me and going for me is my sense of not enoughness. It's my inadequacy. Because from it, I will come to the table here. And I will come to God, and I will come to you, and I'll work these steps. Truthfully, if I could become enough, you'd never see me again. Why would I come here and listen to all this stuff and put money in the basket and listen to Fifth Steps and go pick up these knucklehead newcomers and go down to the detox and pay back the money and, oh, my God. But I've been very lucky here. I've never been able to become complete enough that I could leave you. I think that's my greatest blessing. The thing I tried to run away from, the thing I tried to fix and cure, is really my greatest blessing. I am not enough. It is who I am. I yearn for the power from which I came, because I am not enough. So we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. And that's the trust seems to be the answer to fear. But trust is more than faith. I was a couple years sober, and I had a lot of anxiety. I hadn't really done much on the steps yet, and I was talking to an old timer, and I was telling him, I said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I get up in the morning, I get down on my knees, I pray, I say the third step prayer, and I'm just all day long, I got this edge in me, this anger. I worry about stuff all the time. And he said, well, you have faith and you pray. And I said, yeah. And he said, you know, it's really not enough. He said, alcoholics of our type have been dying of alcoholism with lots of faith and lots of prayer. He said, we have to take it up a notch. You have to trust God. And he said, I'll tell you the difference between faith and trust. He said, if you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire act, and you watched a man come out to the edge of the wire on the platform and he's pushing a wheelbarrow, you could sit in the audience with all the faith in the world and think, this guy's a professional. I have absolute faith. He can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. I bet she's done it 1,000 times. Professional. I know he can do it. And then he said to me, but if you trusted, you'd go up and get in the wheelbarrow. And when he said that, I got this sinking feeling, you know, because I knew what he meant. That I really had to let go of my life and stop maneuvering, worrying, and manipulating, and wondering, and that I had to get in the wheelbarrow. The problem is, I understand what he says. I understand the value of getting in the wheelbarrow. I think it's a good idea to get in the wheelbarrow. I like going to meetings where we read about getting in the wheelbarrow. I like going out to coffee with people where we philosophize at great depth about getting in the wheelbarrow. I just ain't getting in the wheelbarrow, you know? And why am I? Because I'm afraid. I believe my head more than I trust God. I'm afraid if I ever became that vulnerable, if I ever gave it all and got in that wheelbarrow and dropped all my defense mechanisms and I stopped trying to do for me and just totally trusted and relied on God, I'd get in that wheelbarrow, I'd get halfway across that wire and I'd hear that voice. Is that Bob? Oh, no. Oh, shit. because I don't really trust God. So what do you do if you're like me? And you know you should. You know you're burning, you keep hurting yourself based on self-will and self-reliance. You know it. You're causing problems. You know you need to get in the wheelbarrow and you can't. You're just emotionally handicapped. What do you do? Page 53, it talks about what happens to, I think, most of us at some point. And some of us, it happens recurringly. In the very middle of the page, it says, we became alcoholics. And then it talks about a condition that happened to me in my sobriety on many occasions. It says crushed. That's a pretty good word. Crushed by a self-imposed, which means I did it. Didn't mean to, but I did it. Crushed by a self-imposed crisis I could not postpone or evade, means there's no wiggle room here. I can't get out of it. The consequences of what I did are coming at me, and I don't know what to do here, and I am powerless. Crushed by a self-imposed crisis I could not postpone or evade, I had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is either everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What's our choice to be? Out of absolute collapse comes faith and trust. When I was just a few months sober, the first time I ever found myself in this place, I'd been sentenced to 2 years in a state penitentiary in the state of Pennsylvania. And now I'm sober, and I knew the warrants were out, and I knew it was just a matter of time before they picked me up and I was going to be extradited back to Pennsylvania and do 2 years and possibly additional time for, I don't know, for crossing state lines and stuff. I don't know. I think I've heard rumors that they tack on time for that stuff, for fleeing. And a man in Alcoholics Anonymous who I respected, I went to him and I told him about the fear. And he said to me, he said, here's what you have to do, kid. You got to call your PO and talk to the courts and offer to go back there and turn yourself in and do the 2 years. And I thought, are you kidding me? Oh, man, I don't know what the jails are like here, but I'll tell you, in America, they're brutal. They're bloodbaths. I still got scars, physical scars from fights I've gotten into with people in jail cell blocks. I don't want to do the two. I don't jail well. I do not jail well. And I didn't want to do it. He said, what are you going to do, kid? He said, you can't stay sober looking over your shoulder. He said, how long is it going to be until the anxiety of looking over your shoulder just gets so intense within you? You can't even get a job and use your social, your ID. You every time a cop car goes down the street, you're going to be clutching up in your pit of your stomach because you're going to think he's got your picture on his dashboard. How long is it going to be before you're going to be compelled to pick up a drink or some kind of pills or something? How long is it going to be? And when he's nailing me, he's backing me right into a corner because I know what he's saying is right. I know I'm eventually going to, if I don't get through this, this fear is going to drive me to get drunk again. So he walked me through the process. He told me what to do. He said, I think you should write your PO, your PO a letter. And he said, give him the address where you live in the halfway house, which I thought was a terrible idea. I said, no, if I give him the address, he'll know where, they'll know how to pick me up. And he said, good, yes, we want them to be able to pick you up if they want. And this guy, I'm thinking, why am I listening to this guy? And he says, tell him in the letter that you're willing to come back there and do the 2 years and anything they want you to do, that all you care about is putting this behind you. Tell him you'll do anything. Tell him that in the letter, say, give him 10 days. Tell him you'll call him in 10 days. That'll give him time to get the letter. He can talk about it with his boss. And they can figure out what they're going to do with you. Give him a time and a day that you're going to call him. And then you have to call him on that time and day. I wrote the letter and I showed it to him. And he said, that's good. He said, he actually did ask me to change one little thing. But he said, that's a good letter. I remember taking it to the mailbox. I dropped it in the mailbox, and almost instantly, I'm trying to shove my arm in there to get it back. But in the U.S., once you can't get your arm in there. It's your stock. Once you drop it in the mailbox, it's gone. And I had 10 days. 10 days. I can't sleep for 10 days. I got 10 days worrying about this. 10 days wanting to bolt, wanting to run. But where am I going to go? They convinced me if I ran, I'd drink again. The 10th day came. I remember I was so scared inside. I went to the phone and I called, and this woman answered the phone. And she said, "He's expecting you." And a man, she put me through to a man who I didn't know very well. I sat in his office a couple times. A man who I, in my mind, had no reason to stand up for me. I'm the guy who bailed out on him. And he got on the phone and he said, "We got your letter." And I took it to my supervisor and we took it to the courts. And you don't have to come back here and do the 2 years. He said, "Here's what we want you to do." He said, "We're going to transfer your case to Nevada." He said, "You're going to have to go to these DUI classes every week. You're going to have to report to another guy. And he may want you to do urinalysis tests every week. And you're going to have to pay us the restitution and the court costs. And we'll make a schedule with you you can afford. And if you do all that, you're free. And it's not a felony. And it's time served. And it's a misdemeanor. And you're done." And everything he told me I needed to do, I was delighted to do it. I remember hanging that phone up and I walked away from that and I didn't know if I wanted to laugh or cry. I felt a feeling that was remarkable. And it was like a postcard from a God that I don't even really believe in yet. And the postcard said, "Dear Bob, trust us, we got your back. Love, God." It was the first time in my life I ever took actions against what I wanted to do and felt like doing. It was the first time in my life I ever put myself at risk and followed someone else's directions. And isn't that the essence of surrender? If you watch a war movie on television and where they depict someone surrendering, what do? The first thing they do is they throw down and discard all their means of defending themselves. And they sit down defenseless and vulnerable and they wait for direction, for somebody to tell them what to do. And I put down my, stopped defending myself and put down my guard, and I did what this man asked me to do. And God worked through him. There's a covenant in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it's why sponsorship is so important. The argument that people who want to be self-directed and don't want sponsors is, "Well, he's just another drunk. How can he help me?" Well, that's true. He is just another drunk. He can't manage his own life. But I bet you he could do a better job on yours than you can. And he can't manage his own life, but his sponsor can help him. And you can't manage yours, and your sponsor can help you. Because when two or more of us come together for the purpose of recovery, something appears in the midst. When I work with my sponsor, the sum of him and I together are greater than the parts. Something else happens there. I know it. I know God. I've heard God speak through my sponsor. He's given me advice. I later went to ask him. I said, "Did you ever tell anybody else that?" He said, "No, I never did." And it was perfect. It was perfect. So we walk through fear. And that takes us to the last part of the inventory process, sex. Oddly enough, the sex inventory is not about sex. I mean, if it was, I think its fifth steps would be more entertaining, I suppose. But it's not about sex at all. It's about harm. It's about how in the selfish pursuit of my not wanting to be alone, the selfish pursuit of my own gratification, my own emotional security to be hooked up with someone or have a position and look better as a couple or whatever the deal, whatever the drive is, how I step on the toes of other people, driven by self. The bottom of page 68 starts the section on the sex inventory, and the gist of it is on page 69. I tell you, if I get to die and go meet Bill Wilson in heaven, I got to ask him, did you plan that, Bill? Or was that God showing off? I mean, what's that? What's that about? And inquiring minds want to know. There's a couple things that it says before we go into the sex inventory that are very important. It says, we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. It's not about sex. And we don't care. We don't care who you have it with. We don't care how often you have it. We don't care what species you have it with. Well, what we're looking for here is we're looking for selfishness, dishonesty, inconsideration, harm, how we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness in our partners because we're scared and we're trying to manipulate them. We're looking at where we were at fault, and very importantly, what we should have done instead. And that was such a crucial question for me. What should I have done instead? And the reason that's important is if I'm going to turn my sex life over to God and I'm going to ask him to give me a vision for my future sex life and my relationships, I can't help but build that somewhat on the mistakes of the past. And if I don't have a vision of what I could have done differently, what's going to happen is I'm going to get a do-over. This is a very merciful, beautiful universe. It's full of do-overs. You screw up your first marriage, you're going to get another chance. You're going to get another chance. And if I don't know what I should have done different when it comes up again, what's going to happen? Well, I'm going to fall right back into the rut in the road and do the same thing. When my emotions are in play, I'll fall back into the same emotional reactions. That's why our sexual inventory so often is this a pathetic sameness about them. You know, it's like the same. And then I met her and I was it's like the same thing. It's, oh my God, I didn't learn nothing, did I? I'm the same idiot here that I was over there. It's the same selfishness, the same dishonesty, the same inconsideration. And the dishonesty in relationships is pathological for some of us. It's a hideous type of dishonesty because we don't even get we're being dishonest. I tell the guys I sponsor, just try to be honest. I mean, whatever you are, don't create a facade. Don't misrepresent yourself. Don't write checks you can't cash emotionally. If you're an idiot, tell them that on the first date. I mean, just be your most pathetic self. Be it right up front. Then there's no surprises. Even if you're just so pathetic on the first date, you have to go, pull my finger. I mean, if that's you, be who you are, and at least you'll find out something. You'll find out that it's that maybe the sweetest thing you could find out. Maybe that there's someone that would love you exactly as you are. See, I would rather be alone as who I am, and maybe even rejected as who I am, than loved for who I'm not. The book talks about how we create that double life. In chapters into action, it says we create the facade that we want other people to think we are, and we die behind it. We shrivel up and die. I have to be who I am. And I am like most people here. I'm a person with some innate defects. I'm self-centered. I know that's a surprise in AA, but I'm self-centered. You get me scared, I can act selfishly. I'll make amends later, but I can act selfishly. You get me frightened, I can be dishonest with you. I'll come back later and make amends. But I'm all of that. I'm inconsiderate at a hideous level. I've gotten so much better over the years, though. There was years of my sobriety when I was so inconsiderate. I didn't even know I was inconsiderate, and it's not a conscious inconsideration. It's the inconsideration of a person who's so wrapped up in themselves they don't even see how they're affecting someone else. I give you a couple examples. I have a guy, a sponsor, been married a long time. He loves his wife. But they have. He has a big life, and all this. He has to go to a lot of corporate functions, and it's very important for him to be on time. Because if he's not, he looks bad. And his wife is on pay. Oh yeah, we got to be early. I know. I get it. Yeah. And what happens time and time and time again is they'll be getting ready to leave, and they're just ready to go out of the house, so that it'll take them there right on time. And she'll go by the mirror and she'll go, no, not that dress. No. And she'll go back in and she'll start all over again. And she doesn't even see that she's making him crazy and making him. It's not a conscious inconsideration. She can't see past herself. That's the problem with guys like us, people like us. I had an incident. I wasn't sober a whole long time, but maybe closer to 10, I suppose. And I was dating a girl. She was sober about 5 years. And I took my date to an AA convention at the Las Vegas Roundup. A great convention. I think I was on the advisory board that year. I'd been a chairman and a past co-chairman, and I'd been on the committee for a lot of years. And I'm with my date in the hospitality room, and some old friends that I hadn't seen for a while. And actually, I was sober close to 15 years now, because I remember the friends, it was one of the guys that came in and saved my butt when I was about 11 years sober. And they come walking into the other end of the hospitality room, and it lit me up. You know that feeling when you see someone who's really meant a lot to you and you haven't seen them for a while? It was amazing. And I went running over to hug John and his wife, Mary Emma, and Dick was there, and this other guy, Harold, and oh, man, this is great. Now, that's my reality. My date's reality is she just got left standing by herself in the corner of the room as her date just ran off and left her there. I didn't even know I did that. Later, I knew more about me doing that than I ever imagined I would need to know. Oh, I knew later. I'm telling you. I knew. But it's the inconsideration of a person who can't see past themselves. See, because I'm asleep in my own life, I don't see what you see. To me, I don't know that I'm inconsiderate. I'm just, oh my God, look at this. To you, I'm inconsiderate. And my sponsor used to say to me something that's very true. He says, you're not guilty for anything you've ever done, drunk or sober. But you are responsible because you're the guy who did it. It's your job to make it right, to go make the amends. It's your job to clean it up because you did it. Did you mean to do it? No. Did you do it? Yeah, I did. Was it intentional? No. Did it hurt them? Yeah, I guess it did. It's my job to clean it up. And to become awake and try to grow along spiritual lines. And over the years, it's like peeling the layers of the onion, or it's like veils that lift, and I start to see myself more and more and more and more until I start to get what at times I think I can almost see me the way you see me. Maybe not always. And maybe at times I even can see me the way God sees me. And even better, often at times and sometimes a lot, I can see you the way God sees you. And when I look at you the way God looks at you, you're spectacular. You're perfect as is. The great lie we tell ourselves is we're not. And that's where most of the dishonesty in relationships come from, is we believe that old idea that unconsciously some of us think that if you really knew everything about me, the bad stuff as well as the good, you probably wouldn't love me. And so we hide the bad stuff. But it is us. Some of the people I love the most in my life, matter of fact, it's their defects that make me closer to them. Because I got some of that. I feel closer to them. I don't judge them for that. No more than I'd want you to judge me for mine. Isn't it odd that the things we used to hide and become, I was so afraid that this would keep, that I would be alone if you ever knew this stuff about me, has actually brought me more into community. It's brought me out of the loneliness. But I had to trust God. And that's always the bottom line. We're on a different basis. We ask ourselves all these questions, and then on I'll talk about this one quick thing. We'll do some questions. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal. This is really has to be principles before personalities. For guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity. Well, I love the definition of insanity in the Big Book. It says it's a complete lack of proportion and an inability to think straight. When you're in heat, you have a complete lack of proportion and an inability to think straight. So I'm praying for sanity. For the strength to do the right thing. And then I love this. This is so true. If sex is very troublesome, if relationships are very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. I would have never survived the tough times in relationship breakups. I've been married twice and divorced twice, and neither one of them was great. I got to tell you, I feel so good about this. I'm very close to both my ex-wives today. But what got me through that period, that rough patch of road, that dark night of the soul, was helping others. When you're really in a bad place and you're sick spiritually, reading spiritual books doesn't help, does it? Because you can't, 5 seconds after you read it, you can't tell, you don't even remember what you read because you're so up in here. Listening in meetings doesn't help because it's like, wah, 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 wah. Your sponsor doesn't help. Well, first of all, your sponsor doesn't understand. Praying doesn't even help. You'd think praying would help. And I think that doesn't mean you shouldn't pray. But there is no conscious contact. The only thing that seems to help is I need to find a seeing eye new guy to lead me out of the fog of myself, to lead me out of the darkness of me. And those things will save your life. And I am a big, big advocate of service and 12-step work and sponsoring people and stepping up. And don't wait for people to ask you. Go to places where newcomers go. Give them your number. Say, do you have a sponsor? If they say no, say, I'm not imposing, but if you would like to be sponsored, it would be my privilege. You know, Bill Wilson didn't wait for Dr. Bob to ask for help. Bill Wilson sought out Dr. Bob, not because Dr. Bob was an alcoholic. Bill Wilson sought out Dr. Bob because Bill Wilson was an alcoholic. And this stuff, and throwing yourself in new, it's like it balances everything within me. It's the great adjustment. I'll tell you one little story and then we'll quit. In my 11th year of sobriety, I went through one of the toughest patches of road in my life. I'd been married. I'd been in a relationship for 6 years. And it went bad. And I didn't understand what had gone on. She came to me and wanted a divorce. And I tried to talk her out of it. I said, let's try some marriage counseling. And she agreed for about 2 months, and then she said, I don't want any more marriage counseling. I want out of the marriage. in Vegas, you can get divorced quick. It's so fast. You're single 3 weeks and you haven't even paid the visa bill yet on the divorce. It's quick in Vegas, especially an uncontested divorce. I had a 2-year-old daughter who I just adored. I was the first human being to ever hold her. She cried her first tears in my arms in the delivery room. She stole my heart. And I get this divorce, and the day after the divorce is final, I discover that my wife, ex-wife of 12 hours, had been sleeping with one of my sponsees who was my best friend and my confidant in all my marriage problems for the last year of my marriage. And my daughter, who I loved more than life itself, and my ex-wife of 12 hours that morning moved in with my sponsee and my ex-best friend. And I was insane. I was insane. The story of how I got free of that is really contained within the resentment section of the book. But God saved me from myself by service in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I missed my daughter terribly. And I had the rights, according to the divorce decree, to see her anytime I wanted. But in order to see her, I had to go over to where they were living together. And I remember I set it up for this day to spend the whole day with her. And I went over there early in the morning to pick her up. And I drove up to in front of where they were all living together with this terrible, like a wind blowing through the pit of my stomach. It was a horrible feeling of anxiousness. And I walked up to the door and I knocked on the door, and him and her, the happy couple, answered the door. They call my daughter Kate. Kate's about 2 years old. Kate, your dad's here. Kate came running out. Oh, she's the most cutest thing you'd ever seen. I took her by the hand, went and got in the car, had a whole day planned. First thing we went to a place called, you may not have these here, called Chuck E. Cheese. Do you know what that is? It's a place where you get the worst pizza in the world, and for about $90 you can win a kid a 10-cent ring in these games, right? It's crazy, like arcade games. It's crazy. We went there, and they have a 5-foot mouse that walks around, which a friend of mine ended up going through DTs in a Chuck E. Cheese one time. It's a whole nother story. And we spent some time at Chuck E. Cheese. My daughter loves playing those little games, rolling those balls up to try to win that 10-cent ring, you know. And I had it laid out to take her to a ranch for the day. And a friend of mine worked at the ranch, and this ranch had a lot of horses, and it had rabbits, and it had sheep and goats and cows and ponies. My daughter, the idea of ponies just lit her up. She had these little toy pony, plastic ponies, and she just, ponies. She was crazy about ponies. Well, we get over there, and we're playing around with the animals. She got to hold a rabbit, and then it started kicking, and she panicked and dropped it. We had to chase it around the yard for a while, get it back in its hutch. And she got to pet a lot of the animals and feed a lot of the animals, and she got to ride the ponies. And it scared her a little bit. The ponies were bigger than she imagined. But we got to hold her on the pony and take her around the corral. She really loved it. It was very exciting. The pony would go a little faster, and she'd get a little scared and a little excited, and it was very cool. And we're done riding the ponies, and next to the corral is a picnic bench, and we're sitting on the picnic bench. And Kate's thirsty, so she wanted something to drink. So across the yard, next to the stables, is a soda machine. And so I left her there with the woman who I knew that worked there, and I said, I'll be right back. I'll go get us all a can of soda. And I go across the yard to get the 3 cans of soda, and I'm coming back with the sodas. And I hear the woman say to my daughter, Kate, hey, Katie, here comes your daddy. And Katie looks up at me and looks at the woman and says, that's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy. And it felt like somebody stuck a knife in me. And I didn't say nothing, but I pushed those feelings down, put a smile on my face. I went back to sat down at that table, and we drank those sodas and hung out for a while. We did a couple other things. And eventually that evening, I got to take her home. And we drive up to in front of the place where they're all living together. And I take her by the hand, and we go up and ring the doorbell, and the happy couple answers the door. And she jumps into his arms. And I turn around and I walk back to my car, and I get in my car. And I drive about a block away, and I pull over to the side of the road, and I just come apart at the seams. And I'm sitting in the car, and I'm crying, and I'm talking to God at the same time. And I'm saying to God, I love my daughter, but I can't do this. This hurts too much. I'm sorry. I can't see her anymore. And it was breaking my heart. But I couldn't do it. I remember telling God, I'm not big enough for this. I look at the clock on the dashboard, and it's later than I thought. And I was supposed to meet this knucklehead newcomer at one of the AA clubs, and I promised him I'd pick him up there and take him across town to a step study. And I don't want to meet this guy. I need to go home and think. That's what I want to do. I'm a thinker. I want to think. I need to go home and think. But you guys have brainwashed me into the do what you say you're going to do. Show up where you say you're going to show up. Be early. You know, I'll do the right. Oh, God. I'm racing across town to meet this idiot. I get there. He's outside the club pacing back and forth on the sidewalk. I get in the car. Driving across town. We're not even a couple minutes in the car. And he starts crying as he's telling me that he'd been denied by the courts once again to see his kids. I'm looking at him and his tears and his pain, and he can't see his kids. And I'm thinking, you know, there's only one idiot that can keep you from seeing your daughter, Bob. That's you. I thought, I'll see her again next week. And next week. And I've never missed. And she's 24 years old. And she's the light of my life. We've traveled all over the world together. I mean, we've been on cruises. We've been all through Europe and Hawaii. She was in Australia with me 2 years ago. She came down here when I did a workshop in Sydney. And she is probably the most important relationship in my life. And I almost lost it. And that God worked through that newcomer to save me from me. And he thinks I'm helping him. Not at all. Isn't it the helpers that get the help here? So if you're not sponsoring anybody, or if you're not doing service, I implore you to step up. I think you're tying God's hands if you don't. He will work through those people that you're going to help you. I think we got about 20 minutes left. I'm not going to do anything more on step four. That's pretty much good. Do you have something, George? Yeah, do you have questions in the basket? How do you deal with fears about what people think that won't go away? You know, it's odd about fears and resentments that won't go away. They usually don't go away until the amends are made. The unfinished business is dealt with. Sometimes it's walking through something. Sometimes it's hard because you have to trust God enough to face something you don't want to face. But fears and resentments are not things to be ran away from. They're indicators of unfinished business. How often... especially resentments, where you can talk about it and write about it and inventory it and pray about it, and nothing changes until you approach the person and make the amends. Because as long as I owe you, I'm vested in my judgment of you, and it will reoccur because I will have to find something wrong with you as long as we're not even. And some of you may have had the experience of stealing from a place you worked, and you're going to think the person that owns the business is a jerk until you pay him back. It's odd how amends sometimes is the final deal. How do you personally... These are all in the same handwriting. George! How do you personally sustain a positive attitude when alcohol is everywhere in life? I don't notice it. I don't even I go out to dinner with my sister and my daughter sometimes, and they have a drink. And they're not alcoholic. I don't even notice it. Really, you know, when I first started being around people drinking, I wasn't tempted to drink, but I'd be just, you know, watching them and trying to steal some vicarious pleasure out of their drinking. But lately, I don't even pay attention. The last time I was out to dinner with my sister, now that I think about it, I don't even remember if she had a drink. She might have. Isn't that odd? That my relationship with alcohol could be that much changed, that it's just a... Now, if you'd offer me a drink, I'll do what it says. It's automatic. It's a knee-jerk reaction. I recoil from it as from a hot flame. It's like, no, it's like cat urine. I don't want that. But I don't... I'm not an intolerant... I'm not a reformed drinker. I don't mind people drinking. I just got to keep treating my alcoholism. I think that alcohol will take care of itself. Can you tell the firehouse analogy again? Fire hose. Oh, fire hose. Oh, about trying to get advice in an AA meeting? Like trying to take a drink of water from a fire hose. Well, look who we are. You know, throw a question out for everybody. All of a sudden, all the light above every head's a light bulb. I mean, we all know. We all know what the person should do, right? It's a crazy place to have. That's why when you try to get direction and advice from a meeting, what you're really saying is you want to be self-directed, and you don't want to use your sponsor. You're not. What you're really saying is, I'm not sponsorable. I want to come to a meeting, and I want to throw it out there, and then I want to hear what I want to hear and pick what I want to pick, and I don't want to follow directions. I don't want to do what somebody else suggests. I want to be at the helm of my own ship. And let me tell you something. If that works well for you, I'm applauding you. When I was 15 years sober, I went and got a very tough man as a sponsor. And the reason I did that is I had a sponsor, but he was my best friend and he didn't give me direction anymore. I was self-directed. Do that for 10 years. You'll want to be sponsored. That's all.
Can we give him a clap? I think we're on. Oh.